on The Voice of America.
I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. The U.S. says about 8,000 North Korean troops now at Ukraine's border are expected in combat soon. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Russians have been training North Korean troops with the intention of fully using them in frontline operations. Blinken also said Vladimir Putin's troops are suffering.
It's desperate. Putin has been throwing more and more Russians into a meat grinder of his own making in Ukraine. Now, he's turning to North Korean troops, and that is a clear sign of weakness.
Kremlin forces have struggled to push back a Ukrainian incursion into Kursk. The Russian representative at the UN Security Council did not respond. I'm Ed Donahue.
Israel's Channel 12 said on Thursday a Hezbollah attack on northern Israel killed five people, while Beirut said Israeli strikes had killed six health workers in southern Lebanon. Zachary Goldman from Reuters reports.
An Israeli helicopter carrying wounded landed at a hospital in Haifa after Israeli TV reported a Hezbollah rocket attack on the northern town of Matula had killed five people on Thursday. The dead included an Israeli farmer and four foreign workers. Lebanese TV showed plumes of smoke following Israeli strikes in the cities of Tyre and Baalbek. Beirut said the strikes had killed six health workers in southern Lebanon. The continued fighting and rising death toll in the conflict between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters comes as U.S. envoys Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein arrived in Israel to press for a truce in Lebanon and in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the envoys that Israel's ability to counter threats to its security from Lebanon and return displaced people to the north had to be key elements of any ceasefire. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati said in an interview Wednesday he'd spoken to Hochstein and that he hoped for a ceasefire in coming hours or days.
That was Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. This is VOA News. The death toll from devastating flash floods in eastern Spain rose to at least 158 on Thursday. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaparin reports.
A Spanish government minister said dozens and dozens of people were still unaccounted for after a year's worth of rain fell in 8 hours in parts of the Valencia region on Tuesday. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez urged people in flooded areas to stay at home due to the threat of more stormy weather. He said the government will keep providing resources to search for missing people as long as necessary. Opposition politicians accused the central government of acting too slowly to warn residents and send in rescue teams. That prompted the Interior Ministry to say regional authorities were responsible for civil protection measures. Spain's transport minister said about 50 miles of roads in the eastern region were seriously damaged or impassable, some blocked by cars containing dead bodies.
That was Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaparin. Hundreds of Ecuadorians marched on the streets of Quito on Thursday for an anti-government protest, blaming President Daniel Noboa for an energy crisis that has seen power outages of up to 14 hours daily. Ecuador's worst drought in over 60 years has plunged the hydropower-dependent country into an energy crisis as diminished reservoirs leave hydroelectric dams offline, pushing the government to impose power cuts to limit the strain on electricity supplies. The European Union Thursday announced a formal investigation into Chinese-founded e-commerce platform Temu on suspicion the site is doing too little to stop the sale of illegal products in a probe that could lead to large fines. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Temu is extremely popular in the EU despite having entered the continent's market only last year. The platform has on average around 92 million monthly active users in the bloc. At a news conference in Brussels, EU spokesman Thomas Reynier said the probe was being launched because they believe Temu could be in violation of the Digital Services Act, a massive law designed to protect European online consumers. Reynier said Temu could face stiff consequences if it is found to be in violation of the law.
If these suspicions are proven correct, the Commission could decide to impose a fine going up to 6% of Temu's global annual turnover. The Commission will now carry out an in-depth investigation, and we invite Temu to cooperate during the process.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Canadian police dismantled what they say is the largest, most sophisticated illicit drug super lab in the country. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police believe organized crime ran the operation where there was mass production and distribution of fentanyl and methamphetamine across Canada and internationally. Officers served search warrants last week on the drug lab in Falkland, British Columbia, and associated locations in Surrey in Metro Vancouver. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
fighting continues, even amid optimism for ceasefire negotiations.
The continued fighting and rising death toll in the conflicts between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters comes as U.S. envoys Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein arrived in Israel to press for a truce in Lebanon and in Gaza.
Kyiv, Kharkiv, and Kryvyi Rih under attack.
For the past couple of months, it's really every night, almost every night, that the drone attacks by Russian forces are conducted, and Kyiv is one of the main targets.
And celebrations in Japan for a hero of the American pastime.
The victory comes after the Japanese star made history by becoming the first player ever to hit at least 50 home runs and steal 50 bases in a single season.
Today is Friday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We reported on Thursday's show that Lebanon's prime minister was optimistic about ceasefire talks between Israel and Hezbollah. On Thursday, the fighting continued. Beirut reports that six people were killed in an Israeli strike in southern Lebanon, and Israeli media is reporting that a Hezbollah rocket attack in the northern Israeli town of Metula killed five. Zachary Goldman of Reuters has the story.
An Israeli helicopter carrying wounded landed at a hospital in Haifa after Israeli TV reported a Hezbollah rocket attack on the northern town of Metula had killed five people on Thursday. The dead included an Israeli farmer and four foreign workers. Lebanese TV showed plumes of smoke following Israeli strikes in the cities of Tyre and Baalbek. Beirut said the strikes had killed six health workers in southern Lebanon. The continued fighting and rising death toll in the conflict between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters comes as U.S. envoys Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein arrived in Israel to press for a truce in Lebanon and in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the envoys that Israel's ability to counter threats to its security from Lebanon and return displaced people to the north had to be key elements of any ceasefire. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati said in an interview Wednesday he'd spoken to Hochstein and that he hoped for a ceasefire in coming hours or days. Lebanon's health ministry on Thursday said the death toll from Israeli strikes since October 2023 had reached 2,865. Close to a million people have been forced to flee their homes. Israel ramped up its strikes in response to thousands of rockets launched by Hezbollah into Israel since last year. Sources previously told Reuters that truce talks were centered on a 60-day pause, which would entail Hezbollah withdrawing its armed presence from a stretch along Lebanon's southern border.
That's Zachary Goldman of Reuters reporting. For his part, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says that progress in negotiations is being made, though sticking points do remain in implementing U.N. Resolution 1701, which is the resolution that ended the previous Israel-Hezbollah conflict.
On Lebanon, let me just say that we are working very hard and making progress on reaching understandings of what would be required for the effective implementation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 1701. This would be the basis of a diplomatic resolution to the crisis. It's important to make sure that we have clarity, both from Lebanon and from Israel, about what would be required under 1701 to get its effective implementation. The withdrawal of Hezbollah forces from the border, the deployment of the Lebanese armed forces, the authorities under which they'd be acting, an appropriate enforcement mechanism.
Of course, any talk of peace in the region cannot ignore Iran, which financially and militarily supports U.S.-designated terror groups Hezbollah and Hamas, among other anti-Israel militant groups. According to analysts, Iran's attempt to deter an Israeli attack by striking Israel first has mainly failed, leaving the Islamic Republic more vulnerable. Dale Gavlak reports.
Israel's recent retaliatory airstrikes on Iran are said to have dismantled all of Iran's S-300 defense missile system. The strikes came in response to Iran's October 1 ballistic missile attacks against Israel. Iran says it is still assessing damage from the strikes. Nicholas Harris of the Washington-based New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy told VOA that the airstrike showed Iran that Israel has the qualitative military edge when it comes to war with Iran, impacting the Islamic Republic's deterrence strategy.
It's struck advanced S-300 anti-air system, which allowed them to evade Iranian air defenses, and they struck sites that are important for building vehicles for intercontinental ballistic missiles, as well as the fuel for ballistic missiles, which is a key component of Iran's deterrence strategy. They fundamentally wanted to send the signal to the Iranians, but the Iranians are far behind the Israelis when it comes to the tech war.
Writing in the online Dewan publication, Nicole Grajewski, a Carnegie Endowment for International Peace fellow in its nuclear program, said Iran's attempts to deter Israel through direct attacks have proven counterproductive, instead revealing gaps in its own defenses that Israel is increasingly willing to target, and likely places Iran in an even more precarious position than before October 1. Thomas Nudyk, writing in the War Zone, agreed. Putting the Iranian S-300s out of action leaves the door open to follow-up strikes by Israel, including larger-scale direct attacks. This, he said, serves as both a contingent opportunity for the Israel Defense Forces and a deterrent against a response from Iran. It is almost inevitable that Israel has several follow-up options already planned should Iran respond with another barrage, Nudyk said. Another component of Iran's deterrent strategy has been the development of relationships over the years with Syria, as well as regional militant groups, including those in Iraq, Hamas in Gaza, Yemen's Houthi rebels, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, its prime line of defense in its conflict with Israel. Israel assassinated Hamas and Hezbollah leaders, chief among them Yahya Sinwar and Hassan Nasrallah. Analyst Stephen Simon of Washington's Quincy Institute, during an online presentation, said there are a lot of unknowns about Iran's axis of resistance. Simon questioned how much is left of this axis of resistance for advancing Iran's objectives, let alone their own.
Hamas is destroyed, basically, as a military organization. Hezbollah has been very badly wounded. They took a serious beating, the pager attacks, the assassination of Nasrallah and Safieddine and others in their hierarchy. I don't know how accurate the latest Israeli assessments are of the destruction that they've inflicted on Hezbollah's missile and rocket inventories. They're now saying that 80% of those rockets and missiles have either been expended or destroyed in Israeli airstrikes.
Simon added that Hezbollah will find it difficult to replenish its Iranian arms supplies because Syria, as a conduit, is incapable of ensuring weapons can cross its borders into Lebanon. Carnegie's Grajewski believes Iran's response options are now severely constrained, given the weakening of its proxy network and now its own missile arsenal prove both limited in scope and questionable in its reliability. Del Gavlak, VOA News.
Meanwhile, in Ukraine, Kyiv is reacting to North Korean troops spotted in Russia and several large attacks on Ukrainian cities, particularly in Kyiv, Kryvyi Rih, and Kharkiv. I'm joined by VOA's Anna Chernikova.
Well, at this point, Ukrainians are kind of perceive this as definitely as an escalation, and a lot of Ukrainians are wondering what would be the reaction of the Ukrainian allies. Ukrainians really wonder if it will be a reaction, like something more than just a concern. So Ukrainians expect that maybe Ukrainian forces will get more weapons and more possibility to use these weapons on the territory of Russia.
Now, President Biden said that if the North Korean troops go into Ukraine, they would be a legitimate target.
Yes, correct. But the thing is that at this point, North Korean troops are reported in the Kursk region. And also previously, it was information provided by South Korean intelligence and Ukrainian intelligence that some of the North Korean army were present in the occupied territories. And even, again, we cannot confirm this independently, but according to Ukrainian intelligence, some of them were killed. But if we're talking about Kursk region, there is a big, also big question if Ukraine will be able to use the weapons provided by the allies there to fight with North Korean troops.
It's also been a busy week in Ukraine with Russian attacks. We understand Kharkiv and Kryvyi Rih were both We're both the victims of terrible attacks earlier in the week. Can you give us the latest from there and also Kyiv? What's been happening?
Yeah, actually, this past week was quite a week for Ukraine in terms of the Russian shelling, and a lot of shelling, if we're talking about the eastern part of the country, like Kharkiv, for instance, or southeast, like the Zaporizhia region, as well as Kyiv, a lot of residential buildings were affected, were under the attack, and actually were hit. This is, of course, a very deep concern here inside the country, because there is understanding that that civilians are getting even more under the risk, and there are more civilian victims in this past month. If we're talking about Kyiv, just as we began our conversation, it was the end of the air raid alarm, and Kyiv citizens expect more alarms in the upcoming night, because for the past couple of months, it's really every night, almost every night, that the drone attacks by Russian forces are conducted, and Kyiv is one of the main targets. Also Kharkiv region and the city of Kharkiv, for the past couple of months, a lot of victims and a lot of residential buildings hit. This latest attack took life of at least two people, two teenage boys, and thousands are wounded, as well as Kryvyi Rih, also residential area, and also a couple of two people confirmed killed, and more than 20 injured.
Now, you said that Kyiv was under attack earlier, just before we were speaking. Is your neighborhood okay? Were you able to see any signs of the attack? And how are the Ukrainian air defenses coping?
In my neighborhood, I did not hear the sound of air defense, but some other neighborhoods were actually experiencing some loud sounds. And this is usually how it happens. So, for instance, a couple of nights before, our neighborhood was quite a loud place during the night. And even this past night, I woke up actually of the sound of explosion, but it was explosion of the air defense in action.
We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. A moving company and lawyers were expected to be given access to Rudy Giuliani's Manhattan apartment after the former New York City mayor and Donald Trump lawyer failed to turn over belongings to two former Georgia election workers who won a $148 million defamation suit against him. Following Spain's deadliest natural disaster in living memory, crews searched for bodies in stranded cars and washed-out buildings Thursday as residents salvaged what they could from their ruined homes following monstrous flash floods that claimed at least 158 lives, with 155 of those deaths confirmed in the eastern Valencia region alone. Chad's military has been accused of killing scores of fishermen in Nigeria while targeting militants, days after 40 died in a Boko Haram attack in a military base in Chad. A Chadian general told reporters that Boko Haram fighters often blend in with the fishermen and farmers whenever they commit their crimes. It is therefore difficult to distinguish between the population and the terrorists. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. It's time for our look at the American presidential election, and today we head to California. In the closing days of the U.S. presidential campaign, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are both courting LGBTQ plus communities. These voters could make the difference in the seven key battleground states that could decide the election. From Los Angeles, Genia DeLute has the story.
Candace Kane helped normalize transgender characters on U.S. television with her role on the primetime drama Dirty Sexy Money over 15 years ago. In this election, she says, hard-won LGBTQ plus rights will be at risk if Republican candidate Donald Trump wins the presidency.
We can't go backward. And the Republican Party is trying to bring us back to a time where only a certain amount of people had rights. It's really important and scary. And hopefully, as a nation, we'll do the right thing.
Arthur Liu backs Trump because of his record as president. He says Democrats have made things worse.
I like the ultimately the results that he had because the economy was so good. You know, the border was, I mean, you know, it had its problems, but it wasn't as bad.
A Pew Research report published in June shows that about half of Trump's supporters surveyed say the legalization of same-sex marriage in the United States have been bad for society. David Keene says Trump is no threat to gay marriage.
Well, his point on gay marriage was, sure, why not? Because he understands marriage, apart from being a religious thing, which has to do with the church, is illegal. It's a legal document that creates protections for a couple. So I think he has no issue with that. You know, he's from New York, and he was pretty liberal. He's probably the most liberal Republican we've ever had.
Scientist Ariel Johnson worries that Trump would threaten gay marriage and could endanger her spouse's immigration status. Johnson says her biggest concern about Republicans is restrictions on reproductive rights, including in vitro fertilization, or IVF.
I have endometriosis, and so if I did choose to get pregnant, which my partner and I still haven't decided if we're having kids, but if I did choose to get pregnant, you know, it's likely that I would need IVF, which of course is currently a contentious issue.
The largest organization of LGBTQ plus Republicans rallied for Trump this month in the swing states of Michigan, Georgia, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and Nevada. For Harris, the Democratic National Committee this month funded an I Will Vote media campaign with advertisements in 16 LGBTQ plus publications. Polling reported last month by LGBTQ plus advocacy group the Human Rights Campaign found that more than 90% of LGBTQ plus Americans are registered and motivated to vote in this election. That poll gave Harris a nearly 67-point margin over Trump among LGBTQ plus voters. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Immigration is also one of the top issues for U.S. voters as they decide who will occupy the White House. The difference in policy between the two presidential candidates is stark. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti begins our story at a dusty desert outpost in Arizona.
This was a gold mining town, the richest strike in the state of Arizona at the time.
Now a ghost town.
Yeah.
Patty Burris lives here with Bino, her 38-year-old donkey.
Come here, buddy. There you go.
Burris says she's tired of undocumented migrants sneaking across her land from the Mexican border. Former President Donald Trump gets her vote.
He's going to deport them. Yes, I am all for that. Absolutely. Get them out of here. And he can do it. He knows how.
While President Donald Trump ordered that a 740-kilometer wall be built at the U.S. southwestern border. This is the Arizona part of it. On his first day in office, Joe Biden paused any new construction.
We could have had it completed in 3 weeks, but
Donald Trump returned to an Arizona border wall last Thursday. Although the Washington Post reports the section he visited was built before he became president.
Because there's never been a border in the whole world that's leaked like this border, with all those millions and millions of criminals coming through.
Democratic voters at their convention say their party is more tolerant. Sandra Cano moved from Colombia to the U.S. as a teenager.
Immigrants, we belong, the neighbors, we take care of each other. That's really what it's all about.
If elected, Vice President Kamala Harris promises a path to citizenship and the return of a bipartisan immigration bill that died in Congress.
The Border Patrol endorsed it. But Donald Trump believes a border deal would hurt his campaign. So he ordered his allies in Congress to kill the deal.
Back at the ghost town.
So Harris would not control the border as much.
Don't believe a word she says. Where's she been in the last 4 years?
Nobody stops by the old deserted town much anymore. Burris says she'd like to go back to the time when she saw more tourists come through than migrants. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Pierce, Arizona.
Native American voters in the U.S. state of Nevada say they're wrestling over whom to vote for in Tuesday's presidential election. One voting rights leader in the state says it's disappointing that none of the candidates have visited, although they want our vote. Angela Johnston of Reuters has that story.
On the Walker River Paiute Reservation in Nevada, tribal elders are painting pumpkins while talking politics. Some here say they're still not sure who they'll vote for in Tuesday's election.
I don't agree with either one of them.
70-year-old Herbert Dinney is a longtime Democrat from the Walker River Paiute tribe who says he's worried about the U.S. getting involved in a conflict in the Middle East.
If Harris gets in there, we are going to war. We are going to be at war. If Trump gets in there and Trump knows, you know, we may not go to war. And I would like to see that for my kids, my grandkids.
Some of the most pressing issues for the elder tribal residents include land protection, the economy, and representation.
Even though I'm a Republican, I didn't really like Trump.
Herbert's sister Rosemary is a longtime Republican and member of the Urington Paiute tribe.
And I know that my vote will make, you know, it will count. So I'm having a hard time, like my brother, you know, because I don't really like Harris.
Native American tribal residents have long faced challenges voting. This election cycle, voters living on one of the 28 reservations in the state of Nevada have been able to register and vote online.
We know in Indian country that we can make a difference.
But voting rights leader Elvita Martinez says turnout has been successful through the early voting period, and that Native Americans in Nevada make up a powerful voting bloc.
The big disappointment this year in these races is that these campaigns, nobody's been here. Nobody's been to rural Nevada. Not one of them. Nobody. But they want our vote, but nobody's been here.
Nevada is the smallest of the seven swing states, expected to play a decisive role on Tuesday.
It is hard right now to who am I going to vote for.
But the choices left tribal members conflicted.
I keep saying I'm not going to vote, but I know I do. I have to vote for someone.
That's Reuters' Angela Johnston reporting. And finally today, Japanese baseball fans celebrated as local hero Shohei Ohtani added baseball's biggest prize to his huge collection of trophies by winning the World Series with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has more.
Fans of Shohei Ohtani cheered for him back in his home country of Japan after he captured the first World Series title of his career as a member of the Los Angeles Dodgers. The victory comes after the Japanese star made history by becoming the first player ever to hit at least 50 home runs and steal 50 bases in a single season.
First of all, I would like to say congratulations to Ohtani. Thank you for showing Japan your dream. Japan as a country has been down and depressed lately, but seeing young Japanese people like Ohtani succeed in the world is also a dream for old people like us.
It was incredible to see him perform this season, and oh my God, it's so sweet. It's so sweet to get that victory.
After suffering a shoulder injury in Game 2 of the Fall Classic against the New York Yankees, Ohtani struggled at the plate. Still, he called the overall winning season, quote, the best year ever.
I'm honored to be able to be part of a season where we played the longest and to be able to get to know this team as my first year and experience winning the World Series has been a tremendous honor.
In Ohtani's hometown of Oshu, fans gathered at a watch party to cheer on their homegrown hero. While Ohtani did not pitch this season after undergoing off-season elbow surgery, he is still all but certain to win his third career MVP award. Widely considered one of the greatest two-way players in baseball history, the 30-year-old joined the Dodgers on a record 10-year, $700 million deal at the end of last year. He spent his first six seasons in the league with the Los Angeles Angels, never making the playoffs.
That's Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting for us. And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. From Washington, I'm Steve Karasch.